If your morning starts with snap, crackle, pop, and it's not your cereal, call Joint Relief Institute for fast-lasting joint pain relief. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000.
And joining us is the man who starred in All the Family and won two of his Primetime Emmy Awards, is actor, writer, director, and producer, the legendary Rob Reiner. Rob, welcome in.
Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Rob, I was honored over the last 7 or 8 years to speak to your legendary father, Carl, a couple times a year. You know, he kept himself so busy, always had a new project in the works, which I truly believe was the secret to his long and happy life.
I agree. I mean, he used to say to me every day, he says, you get up in the morning. First of all, he used to say, you know, I get up in the morning, I read the obituaries. If I'm not in it, I eat breakfast.
Right, right.
And then after that, he would write, and he wrote every day. And he says, if you have something to look forward to and something you're interested in, it does keep you going. And he, you know, listen, he lived a great life. He lived 98 years, and, you know, I miss him terribly. This was the first, you know, holiday Christmas season that I didn't have him, so it was tough, but you know, he had a great life, and he didn't regret anything. You know, he did. He told me the last couple of days, you know, when, he said, I did everything I've ever wanted to do in my life. I've got three great kids. I had a 60-year marriage, you know, 65-year marriage to a woman I loved. And, you know, he had no emotional loose ends to tie up when he went.
So. That's amazing. Amazing. Well, please accept my deepest sympathies. You know, he was not only a legend, but he was just a sweet, sweet man. He really was.
Yeah, he was. And, you know, we had a memorial service for him. And, you know, I hosted it. And I said, you know, the one thing about him, I never met anybody in my lifetime that ever had any bad words to say about him.
That's amazing.
Nobody. I never heard anybody say a bad thing about him.
Beautiful.
Really
beautiful,
sweet. Guy.
Beautiful to hear. Beautiful to hear. And you mentioned, you know, Carl, your dad was married to Estelle, you know, for 60 years.
Been on their 60th anniversary, they asked my mom what was the secret to, you know, having such a long marriage. And she said, find someone who can stand you. Not somebody you can put up with, somebody who can stand you.
I love that. I love that.
He was funny. My mother was very funny.
Yeah, you would think it was just your dad, but, you know, I've heard you talk about that before, that your mother was just as funny, just had a great sense of humor.
Yeah, she had a great sense of humor, and, you know, there would be great evenings with, you know, my dad and Mel Brooks and Norman Lear and Larry Gelbart, and they really funny people would be sitting around, and invariably my mother would have the line of the evening, and that's why I was so proud to give her the best line in any movie I've ever done, which is I'll have what she's having.
Yeah, absolutely, with Harry and Sally. But here's the funny thing, too, is I didn't know you guys lived in New Rochelle on Bonnie Meadow Drive, and I'm a rabid Dick Van Dyke Show fan and never knew that he pulled that in for the show.
We lived at 48 Bonnie Meadow Road, and in the Van Dyke Show, he made it 148 Bonnie Meadow Road, and now that street has been changed to Dick Van Dyke Lane.
Ah,
I think. I
love it. I love it. That's great. You know, you mentioned, you know, being surrounded by your father's friends and the Neil Simons and the Larry Gelbarts and the Mel Brooks, just to name a few. When did you consciously realize the impact of what your father was doing for a living? So in early television.
Well, I mean, you know, the impact I didn't understand. I did know that our house was different than others, because when I went over to my friends Steve Rabin or Michael Leeds, they just weren't as funny over there. But so I knew there was something different going on in my house. But, you know, I've told this story before, but, you know, my father was on television before we owned a television.
Yeah.
And it was weird. We got a TV in 1951. He had been on since 49, and we got a TV so we could watch him on television.
That's awesome. And he would, you know, you would watch him, I mean, obviously live on Saturday nights, and when he wanted to communicate to you in some way, so, you know, I can't say your name.
Yeah, I mean, it was a live show, and they, at the end of the show, they'd have, like, a curtain call, you know, where people, the whole cast would come out and, you know, take a bow, whatever. And he said, I can't say anything, you know, I'm not allowed to talk, you know, I can just, but I want to let you know that I'm thinking about you and I love you. And he says, when you see me adjust my tie, that's me saying that. So every Saturday night, he would, you know, put his hand to his tie, the knot in his tie, and that meant, you know, I love you and go to bed.
Yeah, I love that. And long before the Carol Burnett ear tug, it was your dad. You know, and you were a fan just watching the show, especially the 2,000-year-old man that he did with Mel. You got to write pretty early on, when you were a kid, a joke for them, didn't you?
Well, I did. I mean, I was 16 years old, and my dad and Mel used to sit in the den when they had either they were going to go on the Sullivan Show or the Hollywood Palace. They were going to do some variety show. They would work on a bit because when they did it on record, it was all improvised. You know, they would just go forever in front of an audience, and then they cut it down and make an album out of it. But when they went on television, they had to, you know, they had to have 5 or 6 minutes and had to be, you know, concise. So they would sit down and work on jokes. And one day I came in, I thought I had a joke. I was 16 years old, and I came in and I said, I think I have something that could be funny. And it was the derivation of applause. And I talked about how in the early, you know, in the days of cavemen, if you saw somebody you liked, you'd slap your hand to your face, you know, go, oh, my God, is that beautiful? That's great. And people, if you really like somebody, you kill yourself because it was so painful on your cheeks. And he says, but then Bernie was the first guy that pulled his head out and then the hands on one of those shows. And it was like, I couldn't believe it. At 16, I had contributed something.
Amazing. That is fantastic. Well, I would assume seeing all this right in front of you, that growing up in that incredible atmosphere laid the groundwork for you to get into the business yourself.
Well, I mean, I looked up to my dad. I was like, you know, he was like a god, and, you know, I just loved everything that I saw, you know, from Show of Shows to Van Dyke and everything. And they tell a story, and I don't remember it, but apparently when I was like 8 years old, I came up to my dad and I said, you know, I want to change my name. And they said, oh, and my dad was thinking, oh, God, this poor kid, you know, the idea of living in the shadow. And he, you know, he wants to change his name. So people, and he said, well, what do you want to change your name to? And I said, Carl. I just wanted to be like him, you know. I visited him when he was doing Van Dyke, and I just looked up to him, and I always wanted to do what he did.
That's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. We're talking to entertainment legend Rob Reiner, and there's more after this on 720 WGN. State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to the great Rob Reiner as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of groundbreaking sitcom All in the Family. Rob, in your late teens, early 20s, you were studying at UCLA. You then went on to do some small roles on some of the top shows of the day. Like, I remember you on Batman, the Partridge Family, the Andy Griffith show.
Batman was the first show I ever did.
Was it the first? Wow.
Yeah, it was the first thing I did. I played like a room service guy delivering something to Burgess Meredith, who played the Penguin or something. And I had like two lines or whatever. But yeah, I did. I was on That Girl. I was on the Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah. I was on Partridge. I did a lot of sitcoms. You know, there was a show called The Mothers-in-Law
with
Eve Arden and Kay Ballard.
Yeah, Desi Arnaz produced that show.
A lot of shows.
Yeah, I was at the National Comedy Center in New York just before all the shutdowns, and one of the highlights for me was seeing Tom and Dick Smothers' Red Jackets and their instruments on display.
Right.
You know, this comedy team so many of us grew up with. You, along with pal Steve Martin, and many people might not know this, you were the writers in the room for this controversial and groundbreaking variety show.
Right. I was 21 and Steve was 23. We were the two youngest guys on the staff, and we were hired in 1968 to write for Glenn Campbell. He had a summer show that replaced the Smothers, and the summer's called the Summer Brothers Smother Show. And then when the brothers came back in the fall, we stayed on and we worked for them through 69. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, to be part of that. I mean, I had no idea because, you know, this was the 60s and, you know, the Vietnam War was going on. There was race relations riots and the women's movement and drugs and hippies and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, everybody was kind of radical. And I just thought, you know, this is the way it's supposed to be. But I didn't realize that Tom was fighting the censors every week. It was so hard for him, and I didn't appreciate it. I have since then. I know to know what he went through.
So you're saying that, you know, you're in the writer's room, you're doing your job, you're submitting the jokes, you're submitting the topics, all that other good stuff, and you really don't know that what you're presenting to these guys, they got to fight to get on the air.
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, you know, you write a sketch and you hand it in, and then the head writers decide if it's going to be in or not. And we would get, you know, like in the last minute, the censor would come in and say, we can't do that sketch. That sketch is no good. And the writers, and late at night, they come and says, well, does anybody have anything that we can replace it with? So Steve Martin and I had written this thing called, it was a takeoff of a Hollywood premiere, you know, people arriving, you know, at the red carpet, and we were interviewing, it was, I think the name of the movie was Renegade Nuns on Wheels or some kind of ridiculous thing like that. And Steve and I played all the characters of all the people coming up and interviewing, and the place went crazy. They were laughing hysterical, and they said, yeah, but I don't think so. No, we're not going to put that in. Then a week would go by, another sketch would get thrown out, and then somebody says, does anybody have anything? Wait a minute, Rob, Steve, you have that that Hollywood premiere thing. Let's hear that. So we'd perform the whole thing again, and they go, nah, I don't think so. They just wanted us to perform every week. I think we did that bit like three times and never got on the air.
That's great. Would you say like that, I mean, even though you were doing some early TV appearances, like being behind the scenes, because I mean, you've done it all, producing, writing, directing, a little bit more of an extension of your college years to really be behind the scenes and understand how this
was
ticked.
I mean, you know, I've often said, you know, that when I was a guy in my teens, every summer I spent every single day during the summer at the Van Dyke Show watching my dad, you know, work with the actors and rewrite and everything. And that was like going to school. I mean, it was the greatest education. And then working on All in the Family, even though I was an actor, I also wrote on some of the scripts. And whenever I wasn't in a scene, I would go up to the booth, you know, where the director would sit, and he would, you know, designing all the shots, because it was done in front of a live audience. So to me, that was like the, you know, graduate school. I got to really see, you know, how things, you know, worked, how a script was put together, and how, you know, an audience would come, and what worked for an audience, what didn't work. And and I learned a lot from Carol O'Connor too, who taught me a lot about acting. He taught me the one great thing. He says, if you've got a great script and a great story, as an actor, you don't have to do a lot. In other words, the story will carry you through, and the audience will take what they need to take. If you feel like you're having to do handsprings and contortions to make something work, that means that something's wrong in the script. So I learned a lot, from all that. By the time I finished All in the Family, I felt like I was ready to direct. And I had already directed, even at age 19, I was doing, you know, theater, and I had my own improv group that I directed and acted in. So yeah, that's something I always wanted to do.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about the improv group, because I mean, that's another place, I mean, obviously, to hone your craft.
Yeah, well, I was at UCLA at the time, and Larry Bishop, who's Joey Bishop's son, he was there, and we started this company with Richard Dreyfuss, you know, who went on to win Oscars and stuff. And we started this little improv group. There was, I think, four guys and two girls. And we eventually got a theater up on Sunset Strip. It was called The Session. And we were there together up on Sunset Strip for like a year. And then Larry and I broke away when the group ended. And we started doing a double act. And we went around. We opened for Carmen McRae at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. And you know, that was a great experience, a really great experience. That was my formative years is improv. And that's why, you know, when I did the first film I did, Spinal Tap, was all improvised. The whole film was improvised.
Amazing.
And, you know, people would say, God, I can't believe your first film, you know, and you didn't have a script, you just improvised. I said, yeah, but that's what I was raised in. That's what I knew how to do. And all the people, you know, Harry and Chris and Michael and everybody else were great improv actors. And I said, if you got the people who know how to do it, then it was actually harder for me to do, scripted shows because I didn't know how to use the camera. I wasn't good with that. And so I learned that on the job.
Quick Dick Smothers story I wanted to share with you. I had interviewed him a few years back, and I said my sister and I listened to
the Smothers Brothers comedy album, Volume 2, over and over and over. That, I mean, I could still recite it backwards and forwards. I said, can you somehow get me a copy of Volume 1? I can't find it anywhere. He goes, that's the joke. There was no Volume 1. We started with Volume 2.
Yeah, I know. They were brilliant. I mean, I worked with them for a couple of years, and then I saw them, you know, a few years back. They were in a club, and they were doing a routine that they must have done thousands and thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And yet, it felt like it was the first time. The way they talked with each other, the way it was just kind of felt so unscripted, and yet you knew every little moment was honed like crazy. And that's the essence of a great act, when it feels like they're just making it up while they're doing it, and they've done it thousands of times. And that they were like a brilliant, brilliant team together.
Then came, of course, All in the Family, which is celebrating 50 years on the air, and there's more with TV and movie legend Rob Reiner after the news next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN, and we're talking to the legendary Rob Reiner on the 50th anniversary of All in the Family. So, Rob, many people might not know this, but Norman Lear had two pilots of All in the Family based on the British TV series Till Death Do Us Part. It was, first a pilot for ABC in 68. It was Justice for All in 69. Those were the days, a second pilot. But different daughters and husbands. Carol O'Connor and Jean were with it all, but different actors both times.
Right. And the first two pilots were done for ABC. And they were two different sets of Mike and Gloria's. And then Sally Struthers and I, I think I had auditioned even for one of them, and I didn't get the part, but I guess I got better as time went by. And then when they did it for CBS, then I got the part, and Sally got it. And so we were the third set of Mike and Gloria.
Well, and you were kind of gearing up, I think, a little bit more for a career still behind the camera. So what made you go for this role and then accept this role?
Well, I mean, you're right. I mean, I was thinking more that I'd be, directing. I'd done theater, like I say, an improv group. But I saw that. I said, this is way so far beyond anything that's ever been done on television. It's, forget the, going to the edge of the envelope. This was ripping up the envelope, I mean, it had never been done. I said, boy, this is great. And I said, I got to be part of this. And it's not going to last anyway, because, who's going to accept this, It'll be on for 13 weeks, and that'll be a great experience, and then I'll go back to doing what I want to do. And so I had no idea that, 8 years we'd be doing it.
Well, and the first one had a warning in front of the show, just to tell people.
Disclaimer.
Yeah.
They had a disclaimer. Basically, CBS said, the views of the show is not reflecting on the view. Basically, it was a disclaimer saying, we don't want to have anything to do with this show.
Yeah, right.
Don't look at it. Pretend we didn't put it on. It's here, but if you want to go to the other room and get something to eat, go ahead. We don't care about it. But it wound up, wound up success.
And you were okay with that up front, knowing that, okay, this might not go on more than 13 weeks. If the next few, then I'll do something else. I mean, was it ever a thought that this was going to catch on, or were you kind of like tentatively going through the motions and doing it, wondering, I don't know.
Well, I wanted to do it because I knew it was a great show, and the writing was great, and the subject matters were great. And, it wasn't a hit right away. We were on for 13 weeks, and people didn't really pick up on the show. Then they ran those 13 shows back to back with the original, and basically we were on 26 weeks in a row. By the end of that, we had caught on, and people were, and then it was that, that water cooler must-see TV. And the interesting thing about it is, at the time, we were a country of, 200,000 people. Mm-hmm. I mean, 200 million people.
Right.
Maybe a little bit less than 200 million people. And, you had to watch the show when it was on. There was no TiVo. There was no DVR. You had to watch it when it was on.
Yep.
So it meant that anywhere between 40 and 45 million people had a shared experience every Saturday night watching that show. And so it had this explosive reality to it, where the next day, over the weekend, people came back. Did you see what they did? Did you see?
Yeah.
And it was the talk. Now you have a we're a country of 330 million people, and if you get a show that gets 10 to 12 million people, that's a huge hit.
Yeah, you're right.
And they don't even watch it at the same time.
Right, exactly.
That's, you know,
those water cooler moments aren't happening anymore, and it's funny.
No, they're not happening because everybody's, you know, it's so just fragmented that, you know, you start watching an episode, you know, a series like, you know, right now, Your Honor is on, you know, with Bryan Cranston. Mm-hmm. And you'll say, if you're watching Your Honor, he says, yeah, but don't tell me. I'm only on set. You can never discuss it with anybody, you know.
I'm watching six of them.
Don't say. No.
Yeah, or I'm watching six of them tonight. Don't tell me anything that's going to go on. Norman Lear, who created the series, he's going to be 99 this summer.
I know.
You knew Norman when you were a kid and was a friend of your dad's.
Yeah, I mean, I met Norman. I was like, I guess I was like 8 years old or something. And we had houses out at this place in Fire Island, which is a beach community. And I was playing with his daughter. His daughter's my age, Ellen, and we were just playing jacks. And Norman watches me, and I'm explaining how to play jacks with her. And I guess I was doing it in a funny way or something. And Norman says to my dad, boy, your son, he's really funny. And my dad says, what? That kid? No, he's not funny. He's too dour, you know? He's too dour. He's not funny. Anyway, he was the first. Norman was the first guy to recognize that I could make somebody laugh. And
that's
I was like
awesome.
Eight. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, and despite your longtime friendship and knowing his family, what was Norman like on the set at that time? I know and I've read that he really was a guy that not only pushed the boundaries of what the content was, but he pushed the cast to do their very best. Yeah,
he did. He did. I mean, that was one of the great, abilities he had, which is he would push people way beyond their comfort zone. And he also encouraged everybody to participate and create. So it was strange because we used to have a run through on Wednesday because we did it in front of a live audience on Friday, and we'd have a run through just for the producers and the director and the writers. And one week we had Herb Gardner came up to visit, and Herb Gardner is a great playwright, and you'd done A Thousand Clowns and some great plays that had been on Broadway. And in Broadway, you know, you can't change anything. You have to get the playwright's permission to change a word, you know. And after the run-through, we're all sitting around, and Norman and all of us, and we're all just throwing out ideas and saying, well, no, why don't you take that line, and let me have this, and everybody is, like, pitching in, Herb looks at it and he says, well, this is like creative communism. I've never seen anything like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, everybody, and that was Norman. He set a tone that said, I want this to be as good as it can be, and I'm going to push everybody as hard as I can to get it to where it was. Yeah, and I think that's what made it great.
And that's not normal. I mean, you know, most creative people want to have full creative control of what they're doing, and to create that team environment and to work together. I mean, that probably created a really great experience on the set.
It did, and I can tell you about one time, because we used to do a show in front of a 5 o'clock, 5:30 show, and then we do it again at 8 o'clock.
Right.
Two different audiences. Mm-hmm. So we get two shots at doing the show. And one week, and I'll never forget it, the first act of the show just laid there. I mean, it was terrible. It didn't get any laughs. Mm-hmm. Second act was strong. And so we did, you know, now we're between shows and we're trying to think, what are we going to do? So we started improvising. The four of us just started improvising back and forth. And they started writing it down. And we went out literally like 2 hours later and just did what we had come up with that night.
Wow.
And it worked. Wow. And that's only because we had a team that was really, really well-oiled, and also people who knew how to work with each other. That was, again, Norman set that tone.
Yeah, as I say, and looking out for each other, absolutely, no question.
Yeah, yeah.
How was, tell us a little bit about working with Carol O'Connor.
Well, Carol was amazing. I mean, you know, people always say, you know, I played the liberal, you know, and Carol played the conservative. The truth of the matter is, he was way more liberal than I was.
Wow.
I mean, he was way, way to the left, and I was more in the middle, you know, kind of more moderate. But he was great to work with because he did teach me about acting and how to make a moment work. And, and how not to push something when you didn't have to. And he was a great contributor, you know, just to each script, as we all were. And so I loved working with him. I he was a great act. I mean, everybody, Gene, Sally, they all were great to work with. And, you know, I miss Carol. I miss Gene. Sally's still around, but, you know, it was like a family. And I could tell you, you know, when people who've done shows, I mean, they do 22 now. We did, you know, 24, 26 shows every year.
Yeah.
And you spend more time with your TV family than you do with your home family. And by the end of it, you really do become close. And so when we did that last show where we said goodbye and we were leaving to go, you know, I guess to go up to the West Coast, there was no acting there. I mean, that was just, I was crying and I was like, you know, it was like over. And
long time to be together.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was amazing. Plus, you know, what was going on in the world at the time. We had, like I said, the Vietnam War was going on. We had, you know, racial tension, not that much different, oddly enough.
It isn't.
We have a war going on now, but not, you know, we do have in Afghanistan and Iraq, but not like that. And we still have racial tensions. But we had all that going on, and we were allowed to talk about that stuff every week.
Oh, my God. You know,
talk about it on the show every week.
Racism, anti-Semitism, infidelity, you know, transgender, women's liberation, rape, religion, miscarriages, abortion, menopause, cancer. I mean, do you even see the show? Could it ever be made today?
Well, I think it would be, you know, I think it would, for in a prime time kind of situation, I don't think it could be because we're living into PC a world, you know. I think, you know, maybe if it's on late at night or some kind of, you know, cable thing or whatever, maybe. But, I mean, it certainly seems like, I mean, the country couldn't be more divided than it is right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, to be able to do a red state, blue state show, it would seem to me it would work.
Yeah.
If you could figure out a way to do it.
You know, the central character, Archie, abrasive, bigoted, a little bit ignorant, but he related to audiences. And I think part of that was he loved his wife, he loved his daughter.
Exactly.
And I think at the back end, he loved his son-in-law, too.
He did. Yeah. He did. And that's the difference between, you know, people who, when you think of somebody who's bigoted like that, you think, well, that they're not human. And the truth is, they are human. And they, you know, it's like you watch The Godfather, and you say, oh, he's a criminal, you know, but he loved his family, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes him human. And we got a lot of criticism when the first show first came on the air. Laura Hobson, who wrote Gentleman's Agreement, said, there's no such thing as a lovable bigot, you know, you can't have that. And we show that you can. I mean, he did care about his wife, he did love his daughter, he did ultimately love his son-in-law. And, you know, that makes the character more interesting. Yes, he was ignorant. Yes, he had those bigoted views, and they were horrible, but it didn't mean he didn't have love in his heart for the people he cared about.
Did you see your role on the show, you know, as, you know, you said you improvised a lot and so forth, but, you know, how did you develop the character? Like, it was written, you know, for you, I would assume in mind to a degree, but you had to make it all your own as well, right?
I did make it my own. Ultimately, you know, I expressed my views on the show, and it wasn't very far from, you know, how I felt politically. I mean, it's not that far, but, you know, it wasn't exactly how I felt, but I tried to adapt it as much as I could to my thinking, and it made it easier for me to say, well, that's what, to me, was so amazing about Carol, that, you know, it was so far from his political views, that's, and yet amazing. He made it work for him.
That's amazing. Norman and Carol didn't always see eye to eye, but I would assume being on set and around them every single day, it was because of the passion and love they had for the show.
It was. There was a lot of tension between the two of them. They fought a lot, but it was always to get a better show. It was never personal. It was never about, you know, I don't like him or him. It was always just getting a better show. And I got to tell you, it was weird because from the age of, let's see, I guess I was 23 when we first started, into my, you know, early 20s, I was the Kissinger. I was the go-between, you know. What a weird thing for a young guy to be the, you know, the diplomat, the peacemaker between the two of them.
That's awesome. Do you ever go back and ever catch an episode and watch part of it all the way through just to see what it was all about? I mean, it was so long ago.
I haven't done that in a long time. When my kids were little, an episode came on, and we're watching, and they were like, they kept looking at me and then looking at the thing, and they kept saying, "Dad, it sounds like you, but it doesn't look like you."
That's great. Yeah. You know, every single episode of those, especially the early seasons, were priceless. But in season four, there was a scene where Archie taught Mike how to put on a sock and a shoe, and that might be my personal favorite segment of the whole thing.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because of all the scenes that we did in 200 and whatever, how many ever episodes we did, when people come up to me, that's the one scene they cite.
Is that right?
They always tell me, that scene when you put the sock on the shoe, and that came out of rehearsal. It was completely improvised. He comes in the room, and he sees me putting on my socks and shoes, which is the way I do it.
Is that right?
You know, not as, most people do it the way he does it, not the way I do it. Yeah. But he says, he comes in, and he says, he looks at me, and he goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean, what am I doing?" He says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm putting on my socks and shoes." He says, no, you don't do it that way. I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "No, you don't, you're putting on a sock and a shoe and a sock and a shoe." I said, "Well, how are you, am I supposed to do it?" "No, you put a sock and a sock and then a shoe and a shoe." And then we get into a discussion about it, and it was completely improvised.
That's amazing.
That's why I think people like that scene.
Absolutely. And it spun off seven other shows. Seven. Like, I don't think that's ever happened again in the history of television. It was the Jeffersons. There's a short-lived show called Checking In, Archie Bunker's Place, Good Times, Gloria, Maude. You know, essentially Good Times came out of Maude. There was a show called 702 Houser Street. I mean, this show is just a machine.
I know. It was like you're hitting the slot machine in Vegas. The coins just kept flying out.
Yeah. Rob Reiner continues to have one of the most successful careers behind the camera, and he and Michelle Reiner just signed a multi-year overall production and directing deal with Warner Brothers Television and reviving Castle Rock. And we'll talk about that next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to the legendary Rob Reiner. So you co-founded a production company, Castle Rock, in 87. And
you
look at these films. I mean, over 125 films. When Harry Met Sally, A Few Good Men, In the Line of Fire, City Slickers, Shawshank Redemption. In TV, Castle Rock produced one of the most successful comedy series in history, Seinfeld. Not to mention your other films outside of that, Stand By Me and The Princess Bride and Spinal Tap. My God. And now you just relaunch the Castle Rock brand with Michelle.
Yeah. I mean, this past year, in May, we signed a deal with Warner Brothers, and we started developing shows. And we've got now, I think, about 12 or 13 shows in development, but then COVID hit, you know?
Right.
And so it's like you can't go into production, really. I mean, some shows are in production, but limited, and mostly shows that were ongoing, shows that had already been on, you know, not too many new ones. And so we're kind of like treading water a little bit until, you know, we can get up and, because like, you know, I directed one little thing. We have one project with William Macy, you know, Bill Macy, mm-hmm. who's in Shameless, you know, mm-hmm. we've got a project about Mark Twain, and we wanted to do a little kind of sizzle reel to show what we're doing, and I'm sitting in my house, you know, and we're mm-hmm. on Zoom, and I'm talking to him, and he's in the other room, and and it just felt weird, you know. It was like, I don't want to do that. I want to be on the set with people and interact, you know. So friends of mine are doing things. Barry Levinson is doing something, and Barry Sonnenfeld has been doing stuff, but they, you know, they got to wear masks and shields, and you know, and it's, I don't know, I'm hoping that by the second half of this year that we can be back to some kind of normalcy.
I like that. I like that you're just going to kind of hold off and wait and do it right. Right? I mean,
I mean, for me, that's I'm like old school, you know. I like to be in the room with people, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, 84 to 92, and I say this with all sincerity, every single film you released became a classic. And this period of filmmaking is considered really one of the great hot streaks in Hollywood. Did you have any inclination that the films from that era, from that time, would be such huge hits for you and long lasting?
No, you don't. You know, you start, you know, you just make films and you hope that, you know, you do things that you like and hope hopefully other people will like them. I mean, you know, we started the company Castle Rock, and that was a way of giving me some creative freedom to do the things I wanted to do. Because I'll never forget, I had done the first couple of movies. I did Sure Thing, I think Spinal Tap and Sure Thing, and then I went and met with an executive at Paramount, and they said, "Well, what do you want to do next?" And I said, "Well, I don't think you're going to want to do what I want to do." And they said, no, we want to do whatever you want to do next. I said, "Well, I've got this book, you know, it's The Princess Bride. I've always wanted to make that." Well, anything but that. You know, it's like, we'll do anything but that movie. And so I said, "Oh, you know, I'm going to have to find a way of doing things that, you know, I can have a little bit more say in how it's done." And, you know, even now when I look at the way films are done, you know, of the 125 films that we made at Castle Rock, none of them would be made at a studio now because they make these big tentpole, you know, these big action franchise-type movies. Yeah. And the movies that I like, you know, the courtroom drama or the thriller or the, you know, a romantic comedy or even a, you know, a human drama, whatever, those films don't get made at studios, you know, so... Now it's all about streaming. You know, you make something and it's on, you know, Netflix or Amazon or HBO Max, whatever. And so maybe I'll do one of those. But then it's not in the theater. You know, there's something about it being in the theater and hearing a laugh, people screaming at something or even in like Misery when she breaks the guy, you know, Jimmy Conn's ankle, ooh, and everybody goes. That's the greatest feeling. You never have that feeling if you're not in the theater. And I don't know. I hope the theaters come back, but I don't know.
That's what I was going to ask you, given this new normal. Like, okay, we're all getting used to not doing that. Now, in the summer, you know, we threw out a screen and got a projector, and we have a basketball court in our backyard, and we set it up, and we'd have social distanced people over and watch movies together in the backyard. But where do you see that future movie exhibition going? I mean, you know, again, I love the movie theater. I love the drive-in. I still love going and seeing a movie at the drive-in, but are there certain generations that are going to say, "I don't need to do that anymore. I can watch it right here on my phone." I mean, I think that would be tragic.
I know. But listen, I think there'll still be room for event kind of movies. You know, big, like you say, big action, tentpole franchise type movies. I used to make a joke. You have to have the word man and a number in the title. You know, Batman 6, Superman 2, Iron Man 7, you know, Spider-Man 12. I mean, it has to be a man and a number. But now, you know, there'll be those kind of, you know, maybe IMAX and great sound and people will go. But, I mean, for the more intimate type films, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there'll be theaters for that anymore. I mean, it would be sad. But people, like you say, they watch them on their phones. They watch it. You know, they put it on pause. They go in the other room. I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, I remember Frank Capra once saying, you know, when you put something in a movie theater, it better be worth people sitting quietly in the dark for 2 hours.
Interesting.
You feel like you owe them something that they should actually, you're telling them, "I want a group of people to pay attention to this now."
That's fair.
And it doesn't seem like we have that anymore. No. You know, like I said, it's so fragmented.
It is a little bit. What an incredible, incredible career. Writing, directing, producing, acting. I mean, is there one place you'd rather be in the writer's room, directing, producing, in front of the camera?
I like the directing. I mean, I like it all, to be honest with you. But I like the directing because, you know, I've said this before, but I'm like an okay actor, I'm an okay writer, I'm okay visually, I'm okay with music, I have a little bit of a musical ear, but I'm not great at anything, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But as a director, you can take okay at a lot of things and you can put them together and, you know, the sum of the parts is greater, you know, is great, the whole makes it greater. So that's I think I like directing because it allows me to take all these medium talents and make them into something more.
That's great. The great Rob Reiner. I am so grateful for the time you spent with us tonight. It's been an honor for me, and I want to say thank you very much. And again, let's hope that we have a much better 2021 and 2022 as things return to a little bit more normal here.
It has to be better, Dave.
It has to be
better. It can't be worse than what we've had.
It has to be better. Thank you, Rob.